Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll talk with one of the nation's leading experts on early childhood development, author and surgeon Dana Suskind. She's part of the 30 Million Words Initiative, a project that's dedicated to raising the awareness of the importance of language skills, not just when kids get into kindergarten or preschool, but from day one. We'll also get a preview of this year's San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series season, which brings some big names to the Valley, including Dr. Michio Kaku. That and our new outdoors podcast, Outdoorsy, makes its debut with a segment about Mineral King in Sequoia National Park and some practical tips about finding the right backpack and why you may want to wrap your car with a tarp if you take a certain road trip in the High Sierra. We begin, though, on a different note. A few weeks ago, we introduced a new series on the connections between healthcare and violence in local communities. Last time we heard the story of Freddie Centeno, a mentally ill Fresno man who was shot and killed by police. His case is an extreme example, but the links between mental and physical health and violence can be seen in more subtle ways, too. Now, some people are comparing violence in the Valley with a well-known condition often connected with soldiers who have gone off to war. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports.
Joey Williams has spent nearly his entire life living in East Bakersfield. In that time, he says he's seen the impact of persistent violence in his community. In fact, he says he himself has felt it during run-ins with local police.
You know, that we have communities that are perpetually traumatized, like myself, who at 15 was, you know, a victim of brutality.
Williams says the incident has stuck with him and made him anxious and suspicious. And he says it's not just him.
Because there's so many other people who are affected by this. You know, it's not just people that are perceived to be gang members or who they call thugs, you know. It's, you know, grandmothers, fathers, you know, people who are everyday folks.
As a result, he says people feel abandoned, trapped, and helpless.
There's no jobs. There's no access to education to go to college for folks. People have relegated to selling drugs and the hustling in the streets. That definitely does create a dangerous environment.
William says for many, there's a depressing lesson learned from seeing and growing up around violence. You are less than another person. What Williams is describing, depression, drug use, aggressive behavior, are all symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Researchers even have a new name for it, toxic stress. Williams agrees, but puts his own spin on the concept.
I call it present traumatic stress disorder, because when you have post-traumatic stress disorder, that means that the trauma has ended. With our people, it's a perpetual trauma that's inflicted almost on a daily basis.
According to researchers, along with the other symptoms, toxic stress and PTSD can lead to sleeplessness, anxiety, depression, and flashbacks. In children, the effects can negatively affect their development. Researchers are finding that people who live in violent areas are having the same symptoms as soldiers who've been to war overseas. Gloria Hernandez is an organizer and mental health advocate who lives and works in Southeast Fresno. She says even for someone like her, who works to help members of her community, its health effects are unavoidable.
For example, if there's a drive-by next door, or the officers are beating up somebody and I witness it, I'm not going to sleep all night. I'm going to be all scared they're going to come back, you know? And so it stresses you out. It stresses. And if I live in the barrio, and I do, I see it all the time.
Fernandez says the effects start in children and continue into adulthood. And many people don't know what to do to find proper health care.
The problem is accessing the services. And a lot of them is it has to be voluntarily. And a lot of people don't have the insight to go and get volunteer services.
It has been a very depressing life to live in this community here.
That's Pastor Floyd Harris, who runs a church in Southwest Fresno. Harris says for many people, the threat of violence is constant and exhausting. For him, one incident sticks out, being pulled over by police with his two young kids in the back seat of his car.
Pulled over by a cop to be looking down a barrel of a gun, that's just post-traumatic stress itself. Looking down a barrel of a gun and your family's in a car, I mean, who goes through that and you normal?
Like Hernandez and Williams, Harris describes symptoms that resemble PTSD, especially with the children who were very upset by the run-in.
That's not healthy. And so when we see something that's not healthy, then it's our obligation to fix it, get it some medicine, take it to the doctor, diagnose it.
Williams, Hernandez, and Harris all voiced a similar concern, that there's not enough resources for mental health care for people living in violent or underserved communities. Still, it's not entirely fair to say the healthcare system has abandoned these communities. As we previously reported, Kern County spends around $160 million of public money on mental health care. The number is even higher in Fresno County, close to $200 million. The county employs roughly 600 various mental health care professionals. Dwan Utecht, with the Fresno County Department of Behavioral Health, says they are changing their focus to address and understand the negative mental health consequences of toxic stress.
Definitely, I would say in the last decade or so, there's been a heightened understanding of the role in trauma in the development of a number of mental illnesses, as well as what we call emotional disturbances in children.
The comparison to PTSD, UTEC says, is uncomfortable when thinking about American cities, but not all that far off. She says they've changed their approach to responding to trauma to try and be closer to the front lines and less stuck in their offices. It's far easier and cheaper, she says, to treat people early before they develop more extensive and expensive problems as an adult. But UTECT also acknowledges there's a social stigma against treatment in some marginalized communities.
Trying to break down those barriers and break down the resistance and the stigma to seeking services, but also being open to the concept that if you don't take the services where people are, you're likely not going to make it comfortable for them.
For example, the department is considering using unmarked cars so as not to draw attention to their clients in tight-knit or rural towns, or allying with culturally sensitive locals to act as liaisons. Gloria Hernandez is one of the people they work with. And they're not the only ones trying to bring services to traumatized people. Ken Katz oversees a new program at American Ambulance in Fresno County that specifically trains EMTs and paramedics to respond to mental health crisis in the field. Katz says they work in conjunction with police during a call, but are often in better position to help a person find the care they need rather than winding up in jail.
Maybe even potentially release at the scene with a safety plan. Maybe take them someplace other than a hospital. Maybe taking them to see that we, in talking to the patient, we discover that they've missed their last appointment with their psychiatrist. Maybe we can call the psychiatrist and we can get them in. Maybe we'll take them there instead.
And the number of encounters paramedics have is somewhat astounding. Over the course of a year, they respond to an average of 24 behavioral health calls every 24 hours. One of those specifically trained EMTs is Robert Wankel. He says the program is already working, telling the story of one homeless drug-addicted woman who he helped get into a drug treatment program.
I gave 8 minutes of my life to this woman to protect herself and also to give her option of opportunity. That's priceless. That is what this community needs for people who are in need of help.
But for Joey Williams, new efforts are too little too late. He references the parable of the Good Samaritan, saying he would rather address the cause of the trauma rather than just treat its symptoms.
Do we want to set up a clinic right there so that everyone who's beaten and robbed can get fixed at the clinic? Or do we want to repair the road and organize to make it more safe?
And addressing the causes of trauma could help more than just the people who live there. The police officers who patrol are not immune to the consequences of seeing or being involved in violent encounters. We will look at the personal effect on officers and what's being done to help them in the next part of our series. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This report was produced as a project for the California Health Journalism Fellowship, a program of the Center for Health Journalism at the USC Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. This is Valley Edition. With so much of California's forest land tinder dry due to the drought, wildfires in recent years have burned enormous stretches of the Golden State. Think the Rim Fire that destroyed 400 square miles and the Ruff Fire that torched about half that. But the thousands of firefighters who are on the line battling these blazes have a relatively new tool in their arsenal, very large air tankers. FM89's Ezra David Romero tells us about these new planes, some of which can hold 10 times the amount of the old air tankers.
When a wildfire sparks, air tankers are the first responders. They're the planes that drop pink fire retardant from the sky to hopefully quarantine a blaze. Here's sound of a jet-propelled air tanker helping suppress the 30,000-acre cedar fire in Sequoia National Forest that ignited in August. Air tanker pilot Brad Baker is stationed at the Porterville Air Attack Base. He helped suppress the cedar fire.
The fire behavior was pretty intense. It was looking pretty good, but by the peak burning hour, 3 o'clock or so, it spotted and really took off. With the other fires going, I think we just didn't have enough people on it.
Baker is one of the 23 pilots independently contracted with CAL FIRE at bases across California. These pilots fly a plane called an S-2. These anti-submarine warfare planes have been retrofitted with turbine-powered engines that drive a propeller.
We're launched usually, typically, first sign of smoke, and we'll go out and work in conjunction with ground troops and try to keep it as small as possible. It's been a lot harder to do that with the fire intensity. You can't really ask firefighters to step into a 100-foot wall of flames.
Baker's plane carries about 1,200 gallons of retardant. With such severe fires, the total load he can carry is just not enough to stop a fire alone. That's why the Forest Service and CAL FIRE have invested in a few larger jet-propelled planes called large air tankers. Mike Ferris is with the Forest Service. He says these recently modified tankers can hold up to 11,000 gallons of fire retardant and work well in dense tree canopies.
The DC-10 is more effective in that type of a canopy because it can release a larger load, and hopefully that larger load can penetrate through the tree canopy and get down to the ground.
With that much retardant, and because they can fly at higher speeds, these large air tankers have the ability to go ahead of a fire and establish a barrier that the blaze will burn up to. CAL FIRE has 27 air tankers in total, and the Forest Service has 21. These planes move across the state as required. Raul Contreras is the U.S. Forest Service Battalion Chief Manager at the Porterville Air Attack Base.
Porterville Base. Copy. 6 minutes out, requesting jetty.
We're looking at a digital map of all the air tankers in flight across the country.
This is the Cedar Fire. When I was talking on the radio, Air Attack 112, they're over that fire right now, inbound. It tells you right now where they're at, 178 knots at 9,500 feet.
He says using these air tankers that once were passenger planes have enhanced the firefight, especially with all the dead trees in the forest.
Now the jets are quick. From Northern California, you can have a jet down here in an hour and a half fighting fire. You know, with the P-2, it takes 2.5 hours sometimes.
A P-2 was one of the older propeller-run tankers. That shortened time span is why these agencies have worked to modernize air tankers across the country.
While the smaller air tankers can get in there and drop precise drops, these larger air tankers help when we have massive fires because of just the sheer quantity of them.
That's CAL FIRE Public Information Officer Daniel Berland. He says the addition of these large planes is important, especially since some of the worst fires have started in autumn.
While we've already seen well over 5,000 fires across California that have burned nearly 400,000 acres, we're still bracing for what could be the peak of the fire season.
That's why Brad Baker at Porterville Air Attack Base is making sure his S-2 tanker is ready to go. He drags and connects a thick black hose to his airplane and fills it with pink retardant. It reminds me of the consistency of a protein shake.
This would hook up.
He says it takes about 3 minutes for the tank to fill. Now that his air tanker is full of retardant, his job is to wait until he's needed in another fire in the region. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero in Porterville.
This is Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Back in the 1990s, researchers at the University of Kansas discovered something that has a wide-ranging impact to anyone interested in early childhood development. Children who grow up in families struggling with poverty hear 30 million fewer words by age 3 than those who grow up in more affluent homes. The idea is that academic success and achievement in many other areas begins far earlier than many previously thought. It's an idea that our next guest has firsthand experience with.
pediatric surgeon Dana Suskind is the founder of the 30 Million Words Initiative and the author of a book of the same name. She is speaking in Visalia next Monday night for an event at the Visalia Fox Theater presented by the local literacy nonprofit Read for Life. Dana Suskind, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you so, so much. I'm very excited to be out there next week.
Since this original research was done back in the 1990s, what's happened in the intervening years? What have we learned since then about this phenomenon?
Well, we have learned so, so much. Both, you know, we realize that Hart and Risley is really the first sentence in a robust scientific literature showing that parent interaction and parent language are critical factors, not just for vocabulary and IQ development, but math and spatial ability, literacy ability, self-regulation and behavior. Really, the early language environment builds the whole child. And the science really shows that it's because of the neuroscience. It's because it is about building a child's brain. And the science has come very far since those intervening years.
Now, you have a very interesting perspective on this issue as a pediatric surgeon doing neurosurgery, working with children who are getting cochlear implants. How did you see this theory play out in real life with your patients?
Well, it was very interesting. As you mentioned, I'm a cochlear implant surgeon. Every week I implant this little device into a child's ear who has been born deaf. And because of this device, they're able to hear. And often they're able to hear and develop spoken language and really have educational trajectories similar to their typically hearing peers. But what happened is when I started our implant program, I saw all these kids who looked like they had similar potentials, but after implantation, they had very different outcomes. Some of them would be talking and learning on par with their hearing peers, and others, same time out, would barely be able to communicate. And it was seeing that difference which really allowed me to understand the importance of the first 3 years of life for brain development and the importance of parents and language for building that brain.
This idea of 30 million additional words that some children hear versus others, it seems like a huge number. Can you tell us a little more about that and put that in context?
Sure. Well, first of all, you know, while Hart and Risley did, you know, extrapolate this 30 million word gap, really they showed much more. They showed that it was a difference in quality of words, differences in affirmations versus prohibitions, you know, don't do that, sit down, differences in conversations. Really, language is the window into the whole parent-child relationship. So when we call it the 30 million word gap, I prefer to call it the power of parent language and the power of parents for building a child's brain. It's much more than just number of words.
You talk about the power of parents. So what can be done? Is this a parental education strategy top priority, or is there something that the education community, the social nonprofit community can do, working with children to help aid in this effort?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think the intervening science has really shown us that if we are ever to impact this achievement gap in substantive ways, we need to start not on the first day of preschool or first day of kindergarten, but really on the first day of life. And partners in this need to be parents. The science is clear. Parents are the key architects for building their children's brains. So not only sharing the information, but supporting parents and using in the strategies for brain building and supporting parents holistically is going to be an important part of the early childhood effort for allowing all children to reach their potentials.
Now, many families who struggle with poverty here in Central California, we hear their stories, and just struggling to make ends meet and working multiple jobs, maybe working in the fields here in this rich agricultural region. Maybe they don't have the time to provide that one-on-one attention and those language skills to their children. How do we try to fill that gap or an assist there?
Sure. Well, you know, I use parents as a very sort of holistic way. I think really any adult in a child's life really needs to understand, you know, the brain science and how critical their interaction is for that child's development. And really it takes a village. We can't put all of this on the shoulders of parents because these children are our children and they're the future of our country. So I think the educational educational system, the early childhood landscape, you know, communities. Everybody needs to rally around what is our most important asset in our country, you know, the children, the future adults of our country.
Given what we know about this issue now, has it led to a reorganization or a reprioritization in social service programs, education programs? Are entities, whether the governmental, nonprofit, are they starting to align along this idea that, you know, it's a little late to start at kindergarten? Are you seeing more of that nationwide? We've seen some of that happen here in the San Joaquin Valley, or at least starting to happen.
Yeah.
Is that happening as much as you would like to see, I guess?
Yeah, no. I mean, I definitely see a shift in the tide and much more focus and interest in the early childhood landscape. And actually, California is, in my opinion, a tremendous leader in this area. They're quite incredible. And, you know, it is the beginning. Is it enough? No, in my opinion. But I think the brain science is really allowing us to understand how important it is. And there's always going to be a lag in sort of the science policy disconnect. But hopefully, as we learn more and more, we'll align our science and our policies much more strongly.
Are there any success stories out there nationwide that you can point to where there have been efforts to take this data, take the science, and actually have move the needle, so to speak?
I think there are a lot of people, exciting efforts population-wise, working on this. Organizations such as Too Small to Fail, Vroom, Georgia Talks, they are all sort of looking at this at a public health population level, and it's very exciting. I mean, it's still early, but, you know, these issues don't, you know, they don't change in an election cycle. This is, you know, a long-term strategy, but I do see it going in the right direction. So let's cross our fingers that it continues.
So what's your message to communities like Visalia and others here in Central California? What should average people do? Or what should community leaders do? What should groups like Read for Life be doing to change this problem?
Well, Read for Life is doing exactly what it should be doing. I think it's really about understanding that parents, communities, investing in these entities are really an investment in early childhood, and that to really move the needle and allow all children to reach their potentials, we need to start from day one with a really a public health approach to growing the brains of our future citizens.
Author and pediatric surgeon Dana Suskin is the founder of the 30 Million Words Initiative, also a book of the same name. She's speaking in Visalia next Monday night for an event at the Visalia Fox Theater presented by the local literacy nonprofit Read for Life, discussing the importance of language and exposure to language and attention in those areas in the early development of the brain of children, starting from the day they're born. Dana Suskin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to visiting next week.
And stay with us. Coming up in the second half of Valley Edition, it's the debut of our new Outdoors podcast segment. We call it Outdoorsy. We'll go to Mineral King, learn some hidden stories about that area, and find out why you might want to wrap your car with a tarp if you go to one spot in the High Sierra. That's coming up on Valley Edition.
There are 10,000 reasons to enter Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. The number one reason: you could win $10,000.
That's right. Tickets are now available for Valley Public Radio's $10,000 drawing. Here's last year's winner, Marcus from Fresno.
Phone rang and I looked down and I recognized the prefix. I thought, oh, I probably better answer that. Looks like I'm going to Cambria. I was a little bit surprised and pleased to find out I'd won the whole thing.
Luck could be a lady tonight.
Your $60 ticket purchase gives you a chance to win 10 grand.
Other prizes include a round trip for two to Seattle on Amtrak and a $500 Amazon gift card.
Only 800 tickets will be sold.
Don't miss your chance to win 10 grand. On September 30th, one lucky winner will be $10,000 richer.
More information and a downloadable entry form are available at kvpr.org.
You're listening to Valley Edition. Pop singer Demi Lovato is known for being outspoken about her past problems with addiction and bipolar disorder. Now Lovato's taking what she's learned on tour with her and letting her fans in on a secret. FM 89's Ezra David Romero went to Lovato's concert in San Jose last month to get in on the info.
Tori Tatum is a Demi Lovato superfan. The 20-something has been to a dozen or so of her shows, including two on the pop star's current tour, Future Now, with Nick Jonas.
Her voice is just amazing, and you never know what she's going to sing. She does a lot of surprises on this tour, so I'm always looking forward to it.
A couple hours before the show, Tatum and about 200 others line up in front of the SAP Center in San Jose for a chance of glimpsing the former Disney Channel stars. They've been handpicked to attend a wellness workshop before the concert. The event's led by Mike Bayer. He's the guy that helped Lovato through her struggles with addiction, eating disorders, and continued bipolar disorder. Lovato says she first asked Bayer for help when she realized she needed it, but didn't really want it.
We've gotten into so many heated arguments and debates over the past couple years, but ultimately he always knew what was right for me, and because of that, I was able to get sober.
4.5 years of sobriety later, Lovato says she wants to remove the stigma around discussing mental health. For a pop star who's come out of perhaps the shiniest celebrity-generating machine in the business, the pairing doesn't feel quite like the usual celebrity with a cause. She says she invited Bayer and his team on tour with her so they can directly reach out to her fans. His company, called Cast, is paying for the workshops.
And I feel like it's my responsibility to use my voice as a platform for something than more than just singing. And so if I can do that through mental health and mental health care, I want to.
The workshop starts out high energy. The MC pumps the crowd up with pop songs, but then gets real deep real fast.
Did anybody here in this room, you've ever been mildly depressed or you've ever been lost in a state of what you felt like was just like a stuckness in your life? Look around. There's nearly every hand in this room.
At this point, Lovato walks into the room.
Please welcome Mike Bayer and Demi Lovato, please.
She waves, smiles, and then sits down on the leather couch. Like her fans, she's there to take part in the workshop. That's when Kevin Hines takes the stage.
When I was 19, my life changed dramatically in 4 seconds. It was the 4 seconds it took for me to fall from the Golden Gate Bridge.
He didn't die after jumping 16 years ago. There's something in these testimonials that reminds me of junior high Christian Bible camp. But when I look around at the fans, they're getting the message. San Ramon native Kylie Prentice says she didn't expect the session to be so deep.
It wasn't what he wanted, and I feel like him sharing that with everybody opened their eyes that, like, oh my God, if I went through with that, it might not be what I want either.
It's debatable whether the youth who really need mental health care the most can be adequately reached by a short 2-hour large group session tied to a pop show. But Mike Bayer says getting young people talking about their issues at all is what he's focusing on first.
What we try to do on tour is give people that opportunity to get some tools to be a better version of themselves.
After the workshop, Bayer's crew offers advice on where to find help, and I find myself wondering if the point of this event will even stick. For superfans like Tori Tatum, it has. She's taking what she learned home.
I've never had that conversation at home. It's like taboo to talk about. You can talk about physical pain or whatever, but every time something mental comes up, it's just shut up.
I chatted with Lovato in her dressing room after the workshop. She was surrounded by her beauty team. She says it's just that attitude she's hoping to turn around. She recently announced that she is part owner of the personal development company on tour with her.
The key is to make mental health mainstream. We have to make it as mainstream as physical health. So when you take care of your mind, everything else falls into place.
If it seems like something of a messy, complex subject for a pop star who rose to fame on a squeaky clean image, it is. But at this point, Lovato says as she rushes off to perform, what does she have to lose? With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Ezra David Romero.
This is Valley Edition.
It's almost fall, and that means a number of Valley organizations are set to launch their new seasons of events, from music to the arts. Over the next few weeks, we'll hear from a number of them. Today, we turn our attention to one of the Valley's oldest groups presenting regular public speeches, the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. Joining us now in the studio, we have two board members, Lisa Cooper, and also with us today, we have Paul Smith with the group. Paula, I want to start with you. You were part of the committee that put together this year's season. Quite a varied group, some very big names from Dave Barry to Leon Panetta and to some other rising stars and people who might not be household names but are involved with projects that are definitely household names. You're kicking things off, though, in a big fashion coming up next Wednesday, though. What's happening?
That's correct. Well, thank you. We're very excited about this year's program. The first event is an evening event, and it's kind of a special kickoff event, and we have Dr. Michio Kaku. Michio Kaku is a founder of string theory. He is a popularizer of science. He's a kid who, for his science high school project, put together a 2.3 million volt atom smasher and blew out all the electricity in his neighborhood. So that's the kind of guy we're meeting with, and you have the opportunity to come hear him speak about all the things that are going on in science today. And his focus is on the future of the mind, telekinesis, artificial intelligence. I mean, it's really incredible subject, and he's a great, funny speaker.
He really does have a way of popularizing or making accessible really advanced scientific concepts. I imagine that has to attract you as someone who's looking to put together the season. Is that part of the appeal of bringing someone of his stature and also popularity?
Absolutely. I mean, he's a guy that everyone, if you haven't seen him, you'll know him when you see him immediately. He's what people are calling today the modern Einstein, and to have a speaker of that stature here in Fresno is incredible. And right now, that evening event, there's not a lot of tickets left. So if people want to see that, that's next Wednesday, September 21st at 7:30 at the Sorian Theater. Please go to our website at valleytownhall.com, and you can purchase tickets.
Now, Lisa, you've been involved with Town Hall for a while. Now, you used to serve on the committee that selected the speakers. What do you look for in trying to balance out a season and trying to get some familiar names, some new names? And oftentimes I see there'll be names that are in the news. It just so happens that these are people who are doing really interesting things. How does Town Hall approach something like putting together the season?
Well, that's a great question. I think what we aim to do is try to find somebody in each category: science, art, politics, the humanities. And we try to find the rock star in that field. And as our former president, Jolene Tellis, said, it's those town hall moments when we get Leon Panetta, we get a Dr. Kaku, we find Bob Arnott, we get the town hall, we get the chef from the White House, we get those cutting edge people, and we work very hard at it. We read the books that they write. We talk to people in the community. It's meeting after meeting and review after review.
So you have that one event in the evening. The rest of your lectures are in the morning. Tell us about the first regular lecture in your series.
Well, again, one of the things, as Lisa was alluding to, I like to call it the sausage. We put together this program where the sausage is absolutely delicious, but putting it together is not always the easiest thing, or you really don't want to know what goes into it. Leon Panetta is our first speaker on October 19th. What an incredible speaker. It's a month before the elections, and we have the opportunity to get one of the great, the defense, Secretary of Defense, Director of CIA, who's actually in Europe right now lecturing. So it's an incredible opportunity to come see him and see what he has to say about what's going on in the United States. Again, that's Leon Panetta on October 19th.
Then you follow it up with Wes Moore talking about the other Wes Moore and his book about that, his doppelganger, I guess you could say.
So one of the great things about this lecture series, it's not always the speakers you've heard of that are the best speakers. Wes Moore is an African-American who grew up in the inner city of Baltimore, ended up with a Rhodes Scholarship after being in trouble with drugs and inner city issues. He has an article printed on him about how he has a Rhodes Scholar. A month later or so, another person by the name of Wes Moore, same circumstances, inner city, is actually on the front page of the paper for having shot a police officer. He ends up going to jail for life. Wes Moore afterwards starts contacting the other Wes Moore in jail and creates this relationship. So he talks about all the issues that are going on in our nation right now. And one of the things I like to say, town hall is a community conversation, and these are one of the great conversations we need to have.
Now, one of the names I can say I've not heard of is Adam Stelzner, but I certainly have heard of the project he worked on, the Mars rover.
Mars rover, Curiosity. It's on Mars right now. It's incredible. This is a guy who actually was in a punk rock band, completely lost, saw the stars, constellation Orion, in the evening one night and said, I wonder why it's moving. Why is it here one night and there the next? Takes an astronomy class, and now he's a JPL engineer was a lead engineer scientist who put the Mars rover Curiosity on Mars right now. He's going to come tell us about that experience and also what's going on with Mars. Let's see some pictures and let's discuss what the future is.
Very exciting. Lisa, when you go through selecting the season, is it a process of, well, you know, we like this person, this person's not available on this day, we need to try to work something out, and, well, do people really know who Mr. Stelzner is, or Stelzner, excuse me? How do you balance all those things?
Well, what we do is we watch TED Talks as a group. We start very early in the year. We work a year in advance, and we watch people on YouTube. We review them on television shows. As I said before, we read their books. And we as a group really do thoughtful analysis on how to bring the best person in their respective field. And sometimes we take a risk. I was telling Paul earlier this morning that when I've talked to people just in the audience, general audience, when they're leaving or they're coming to town hall, they always thank us and say, wow, I thought the guy on the redwood trees was phenomenal. I didn't think that would be very good, but what an incredible experience. So those are those town hall moments, and we've captured those each time.
You continue in February with a talk on the four films that changed America by Mark Lapidula. Tell us about him.
Well, Mark Lapidula from Yale, I mean, let's think about February, first of all. That's the Academy Awards, right? So how interesting is it to have someone who is an expert on film coming to talk about the four films that changed America? I mean, if you think about it, there are films that we see every year that will change the way we look at things. One of the films he's going to talk about is Philadelphia and how it changed the AIDS issues in America. So I understand he's a fascinating guy, talks with authority, Academy Awards. Let's talk about some great films that changed America.
One name that needs no preface is Dave Barry, the great humorist. That has to be also a highlight of the season.
You know what? It's fascinating because when we select these speakers, not everyone agrees. And one of the great pleasures for me, because I love Dave Barry, is to see how much everyone is thrilled about having him come here. He is for people who don't know, a humorist. He's a humorous column appears in more than 500 newspapers. He's won a Pulitzer Prize. And, you know, one of the great things is you just never know what's going to happen because you have Dave Barry. He could really talk about anything, but you will be laughing. It'll be a great evening or a great day.
And then you close out the series with a talk about Alzheimer's.
That's correct. Lisa Genova is known for the book Still Alice, which deals with Alzheimer's issues, but also won an Academy Award for the woman who starred in the role. But she is an expert in the field of Alzheimer's and issues of the brain. And she's coming here to talk about, you know, how her experience with her own experiences with Alzheimer's led her to write the book and really is a well-known speaker and really excited to have her.
All those events take place at the Soroyan Theater in Fresno, the Fresno Convention Center. Again, Michio Kaku speaking about the future of the mind and all things science coming up next Wednesday and that special evening event, San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. If people want to find out more information about the group, what can they do?
Well, they can go to our website, www.valleytownhall.com, and they can also call 444-2180.
All right, we're looking forward to this year's season. Some big names and some fascinating speakers, Lisa Cooper and Paul Smith from the San Joaquin Valley Town Hall Lecture Series. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to Valley Edition. On today's show, we're doing something a little different. We're not only launching a new segment, we're launching a new standalone podcast. It's all about the outdoors and the amazing opportunities to explore nature that are all around us here in Central California. You'll hear the segments here on Valley Edition, and you can also find them on kvpr.org. Today, we begin with a trip to a hidden gem of Sequoia National Park, Mineral King. Here's Outdoorsy.
At some time, the whole valley became taboo. There was something that was scary, but they never revealed it.
I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein.
This is Outdoorsy, a new podcast from Valley Public Radio. We take you to wild places in Central California and introduce you to the people who explore them.
The first place we're focusing on is the valley you heard about in the teaser, and it's a secluded spot called Mineral King. It's in Sequoia National Park. That's where the famous big trees are, but it's quite a ways south. The only way to get there is to take the 99 to Visalia and head east on Route 198, this two-lane highway that slowly climbs into the mountains.
After this tiny town called Three Rivers, you take a turn off onto a long, windy mountain road that's only open between Memorial Day and October when there's no snow on the ground. It's really long, like 30 miles. But don't be scared, it's actually quite fun. From Fresno, the whole trip takes about 2.5 hours.
And you are totally rewarded for that long drive. Mineral King is this stunning valley at about 10,000 feet that was carved by glaciers. Picture flower-filled meadows, steep granite hillsides leading up to jagged peaks like Sawtooth, and cascading lakes and waterfalls.
Below all that, the Cuya River cuts through the valley. This area has attracted prospectors, Native Americans, and even Disney. Today, there's a lot to do at Mineral King. I went day hiking and car camping.
And I went backpacking. In this show, we'll talk about our trips, go through some history, and talk to an expert on how to buy a backpack.
On my trip, I met with a local historian named Louise Jackson. We chatted in front of her cabin right next to the river.
My great-great-grandfather built the road up here. Our family considers ourselves very much a part of Mineral King.
Her family built a cabin in one of Mineral King's most picturesque meadows. She says Mineral King is like a secret place in the Sierra Nevada.
It is such a microcosm of everything geologically that the entire southern Sierra Nevada encompasses. From our right over here, Vandiver Mountain, there is an undersea volcano. In the mountains all around, you'll see a lot of color, which excited the miners who came in.
In the 1870s, Mineral King wasn't part of Sequoia National Park. Prospectors came here to mine gold and silver. They didn't pan out. But what did was a mineral called galena that contains lead. Jackson says there's a lot of mystery in Mineral King. Native Americans used the area as a trading trail about 3,000 years ago.
At some time, the whole valley became taboo. The ancestors of the native people never passed it on what it was exactly that said that the people should no longer come in here. And so when the first miners came in and the road was going to be built, the fellow who had the franchise to build the road could not get the local Indians during a really difficult drought and recession time to come up here and work the road, even though they were hungry, because there was something that was scary, but they never revealed it.
In the 1940s, skiing was very popular in America. The Forest Service opened Mineral King to the idea of being developed for skiing. Even though it's remote, it got the attention of some really high-profile people, like a Hollywood producer and an actress.
Beautiful, except
a certain group of people who had the Disney Corporation had been thinking of the same thing. They did not ask the Forest Service to open it up yet, but just on the sly, they began gathering property here.
Disney began taking the area over cabin by cabin, and that didn't make everyone happy. You know, they didn't want this area to become a European-style resort. That's when the Sierra Club took the U.S. government to court to try and protect the land from development. The case made it all the way to the Supreme Court. I found some archival audio from that case.
The Sierra Club brought this proceeding against the Secretaries of Agriculture and Interior.
This is Leland Selman Jr. He argued on behalf of the Sierra Club.
A huge private recreational development at Mineral King, and for a state highway across Sequoia National Park to reach that development, were illegal.
The Sierra Club lost the case, so Disney could have built here, but
Roy Disney, who ran the finances of the Disney Corporation, never did want to be here. And Walt, who was the big skier, wanted it. Walt Disney died, and that took care of that as far as Roy was concerned. They put all of their money into Disney World.
So you're saying that if Walt hadn't died, we could have had this immense Disney ski chalet up in this part of the Sierra?
Yeah, exactly. Like Disneyland in the woods, Mickey Mouse everywhere.
Oh, my God.
Well, the lawsuit did do something good, Carrie. Jackson explains.
The dissenting opinion probably set up the most succinct background and defining purpose of the environmental movement, but as to why the land is a proper litigant, the land could speak for itself.
Justice William Douglas wrote that famous dissent. The full text of that paper is on our website. Mineral King became part of Sequoia National Park in 1978. The next day, my friends and I went on a hike to a place called Franklin Lake. It's a 13-mile round-trip hike. We were really tired, so we went back to our campsite at Atwill Mill Campground. We had dinner, a few beers, and we went to sleep.
That sounds like a perfect Mineral King day.
It really was. It was awesome.
So when I went to Mineral King, I went backpacking. And the first difference between backpacking and day hiking in Mineral King is that to be out in the wilderness overnight, you need to get a permit in person. And the ranger station closes at 4 p.m. sharp.
Okay.
Made it.
We got there just before it closed, and a smiley ranger named Alicia helped us out.
All right. Could I have one of you fill out your name and address here, please? And
sure.
I can fill the rest.
She gave us her ranger spiel, so make sure you take all your trash out with you, that includes toilet paper, don't walk off the trails and trample plant life, put all of your food and smelly stuff in a bear canister. But then she told us something I had never heard before, Ezra, which was that we should wrap up our car.
Just lay the tarp down, drive over it, and then if you have cord or bungees, wrap it around. Basically, you want to make sure that the wheel wells are covered and the whole bottom half of the car, or else they'll still be able to get in.
Oh, okay.
What's she talking about? What's going to get into these cars?
She's talking about marmots, these fat rodents that look kind of like a mix between squirrels and groundhogs. They're notorious among hikers for sneaking into camps and stealing food, and apparently also sneaking into cars if they're parked there long enough and gnawing through spark plugs and other wiring. So the parking lot is full of these cars and trucks that basically look like they're in diapers. But Alicia points out this kind of damage is actually really rare. Plus, tarps are cheap and wrapping your car is really easy. So after that, we hiked a mile to Groundhog Meadow. We pitched our tent next to a waterfall. We had the place completely to ourselves. It was so peaceful. The next morning, we made some tea and oatmeal and then trekked up about 3 miles to Monarch Lakes. Around a dozen people were there. They were picnicking, camping. Some were even having a snowball fight with this little remaining patch of snow. This was August, by the way. But we kept going. We hiked another 3 miles to Crystal Lake, which was gorgeous and nearly pristine. It perfectly encapsulated that Mineral King postcard of dramatic mountain peaks and colorful hillsides dotted with wildflowers and bright blue lakes. It was amazing, except
that was a challenging hike.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had no idea it was going to be that tough.
We didn't either.
I don't want to take another step uphill.
That's fine. I was like, I'll sit here, stuff, enjoy the scenery.
So the difference between my hike and your backpacking trip is like you had to bring a lot of stuff. I didn't have to. I just brought some food, some first aid, and some water.
Right. We basically packed everything we'd need for 3 days. So I figured I'd take a few minutes now to talk about one of the essentials there, which is the backpack itself, like how to shop for one and how to make sure it fits. So I found an expert, a self-taught wilderness enthusiast. Ezra, I want you to meet Elizabeth Frelix, a woman with 9 different backpacks.
The quest for the perfect backpack is ongoing. This is the one I took to the Grand Canyon.
Frelix actually has an entire room dedicated to outdoor gear, including a map on the wall of where she's been.
We day hike almost every weekend. And then in the summer, we backpack. This summer I probably did 100 miles backpacking.
Her first big hike was Half Dome. It's a pretty tough day hike in Yosemite that involves a somewhat treacherous cable ladder.
I made an attempt with all of my sisters on my 50th birthday. We didn't know very much about it, and the cables weren't up. So we got to the subdome, and then we had to come back. But it was enough of a taste. The preparation for that was what really got me hooked.
But early on in day hiking, she really caught the backpacking bug.
You know, when you go day hiking, you have all these lovely days, and you see all of these beautiful things, and you keep passing people that get to spend the night. And so that was what really got me interested, is like, oh my gosh, all these other people are going on and they're going to get to stay and I've got to come back and drive home. And I wonder what it would be like to do that over multiple days.
Within no time, she had signed up for an 83-mile, 9-day trip across the Sierra to Mount Whitney. This all after her 50th birthday.
She sounds like a badass.
She is so badass.
I am somebody who came late to backpacking, but have developed a passion for it that kind of make up for lost time.
So, naturally, when she first started backpacking, she didn't know a lot about what gear to buy.
The first backpack I bought, I made quite a few mistakes because I went all for comfort without thinking about the amount of weight I was going to have to carry, so I bought a really heavy backpack. It weighed 6 pounds. I had no scale in my head of what that meant.
That weight adds up when you consider that you're not just carrying clothes and water, but also bulky things like a tent, sleeping bag, sleeping pad, and maybe a bear canister. So aside from weight, bags that size are also measured in liters.
My day pack, my Old Faithful, is about, I think it's a 25 liter. And then my multi-day pack is 60 and opens up to 65 liters. I think a lot of people get by with a lot less. They can carry a bear canister in a 50 liter, depending on how much you want to carry on the outside of the pack.
And Frelix says it's important to make sure it fits.
My first clue is if it's dragging on my shoulders. If it's pulling on my shoulders, I've got something that's not adjusted correctly. I mean, it really is worth the time to go in and get fitted and to buy the right size to begin with.
So what about men's versus women's packs? Is there a difference there?
You know, I've been using a men's pack right now, a small men's pack, and I have noticed that women's straps are cut in a curve, and I could feel the men's pack rubbing my shoulders. So if there's a difference, that might be it. Other than that, I've read that they may have more padding on the hips. I read about women that have problems with blistering across their hips.
Really, Frelix says, there are no rules. You just have to figure out what's right for you.
I think that if you're going to start, you should try to borrow and get on blogs and talk to friends and find out as much as you can that way before you go out and invest a bunch of money. You know, don't be embarrassed. Most backpackers are just like thrilled to share their hobby with you. And if they have extra stuff, they'll loan it to you. So, and then I would say don't be afraid of making mistakes. Because if you really get into backpacking, in 2 years you're not going to have the same stuff you started with. I guarantee it. So just get out there and do it.
But even if backpacking doesn't really seem like your jam, there's probably still something for you at Mineral King.
Yeah, like pie. There's this place called Silver City Resort where you can rent a cabin, but they also have this restaurant where you can get a burger and pie.
We have chocolate walnut, apple streusel, peach, fruit of the forest, razzle dazzle.
I got peach.
I ordered razzle dazzle.
And you know, it makes this long, windy drive back to reality better.
Totally.
And that's today's show. Our editor is Joe Moore, and we had engineering help by Don Weaver.
Our music is by Kevin McLeod and Ben Sound.
Stay tuned for future shows when we visit other wild places and interview the people who visit them. I'm Ezra David Romero.
And I'm Carrie Klein. Thanks for listening.
Bye. And we hope you enjoyed the debut
edition of our new podcast, Outdoorsy. You can hear those segments on Valley Edition every once in a while. We'll have more of those to come. For Valley Edition staff, including reporter and producer Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. Remember, send us your emails, talk@kvpr.org, and a tweet @kvpr and @Valley Edition. Our audio archives and podcast online at well at kvpr.org. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.